From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, Hollywood's actors' unions file for an untimely divorce. Then, what happens to a novice TV writer when she gets her own show? We talk to Caroline Williams, the creator of the ABC comedy Misguided. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. Oh, no. We're back to labor news. After 27 years of unhappy codependency, the two largest actors' unions, SAG and AFTRA, have decided to break up, at least when it comes to sitting down with Hollywood's producers and negotiating a new contract. Their current deal expires June 30th. We'll have more about the actors' attempts to screw up their negotiations even before they begin later in the show. Speaking of painful divorces, America's top-rated Spanish-language broadcaster, Univision, may be in agua caliente. It's facing down a $118 million lawsuit from Mexican TV programming provider Televisa. The trouble started back in 1992, when Televisa signed an agreement that gave Univision the exclusive right to air Televisa programming in the U.S. for 25 years. Since then, Univision's primetime audience has nearly tripled, and Televisa says they've been tremendously underpaid. If Univision loses the suit, 15 of its 20 hours of weekly primetime programming will evaporate, including 3 hours of telenovelas every weeknight. And Televisa shows account for 40% of Univision's ad revenue. Ay, papi! Elsewhere, Apple's Steve Jobs floated a plan last month that would have increased the cost of iPods, but would have also made music downloads effectively free. And Jobs, the most powerful man in the music business. Of course, the record labels would have had to play along with Jobs, but it appears they're taking their ball and going home. You see, last week, the top three record labels, Sony BMG, Universal, and Warner Music, all announced they were taking a stake in a new venture with MySpace. The new MySpace download service will be a direct competitor to iTunes, which shows just how much the labels fear and or loathe Steve Jobs. To wit, Universal has been embroiled in litigation with MySpace over copyright violations, but that suit is now expected to be settled. Remember, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Finally, legal lessons from the conspiracy and wiretapping trial of disgraced private investigator to the stars, Anthony Pelicano. Our legal analysts suggest that it is a poor tactic to admit suggesting to a client that you could have his enemy killed and buried in the desert outside Las Vegas. Yet, according to the New York Times, Pelicano, who is serving as his own attorney, did just that in open court. In a cross-examination of a hostile witness, Pelicano said, quote, "Didn't Mr. Pelicano say, 'You've spent all this money, why don't you just whack him?' Didn't Mr. Pelicano say, 'If you feel so badly about it, why don't you just have him killed?' We say, doesn't Mr. Pelicano know that referring to oneself in the third person is just plain crazy?" And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the program, the Caroline Williams method to quick success in Hollywood. But first, SAG says to AFTRA, "It's not me, it's you." The Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists have historically put up a united front in contract negotiations with producers, even while things were tense at home. The two unions have somewhat different jurisdictions. SAG covers filmed entertainment, whether it's TV or movies. AFTRA covers taped entertainment, like soap operas and chat shows. SAG has about 120,000 members, AFTRA about 70,000, and there are about 40,000 actors that belong to both unions. Because of that overlap, and to avoid being played against each other, they usually negotiate jointly. But just a week after AFTRA announced they'd once again join forces with SAG, they reversed themselves. And so each union will act alone in renegotiating the contract that expires June 30th. The good news for actors? AFTRA will let its estranged big brother SAG negotiate first. Now, the studios would have preferred to begin talks with AFTRA, the smaller of the two unions, because it's less confrontational and more likely to go for a lightweight deal. The bad news? AFTRA is only giving SAG a 2-week head start before starting its own negotiations with producers. AFTRA said it would begin its talks on April 28th, 2 weeks after SAG's April 15th start. Why is all this happening now? What could it mean for strike-weary Hollywood and for your TV viewing pleasure? Joe Adalian is co-TV editor at Variety. Full disclosure, Joe is also a card-carrying member of AFTRA because he occasionally appears on the Fox Reality Channel show Reality Remix. All right, so Joe, AFTRA wrote a letter to SAG saying, "We're in it with you guys. You can count on me." And then a week later, they're gone. What happened?
You know, these two sides, these two unions historically have had a very tenuous relationship at best. Despite all the talk of union solidarity, SAG and AFTRA often have conflicting points of view, conflicting agendas, and I think it was just more internal sniping that just sort of, just got the best of them. They just disagree on some key issues, and they don't like each other, and that's what happened.
So what are the issues?
Well, you know, one of the big things that's at an issue here is that there's a feeling that the relationship has been made more equal than it deserves to be. You know, SAG is the dominant union among television actors. It covers most film work, which is about 90-95% of TV shows that we watch. But AFTRA, historically, negotiations has been given equal representation when SAG and AFTRA have negotiated together. It's sort of a 50-50 split. And that rubs some people the wrong way, and especially at SAG. Alan Rosenberg, the president of SAG, wanted to change that, and that caused a big kerfuffle. Another thing that did help was recently there was a spat over SAG trying to take to get the actors on The Bold and the Beautiful, a CBS daytime soap opera, to ditch AFTRA and go to SAG. SAG has said, no, we haven't been doing that. That's something the actors have been doing. Nonetheless, it caused a major imbroglio and sort of led to yet further friction between these two unions.
So is it personal? I mean, is it a turf thing, or are there genuine issues here?
I don't think it's about necessarily a personalities, although certainly there are people who think the SAG leadership has been particularly aggressive. But at the same time, I think it's really simply a matter of SAG being aggressive at representing its interests and believing that it is more likely to make a deal that's fair for its members. I mean, historically, SAG has been taking a harder line in a lot of the issues that are important to actors, whereas AFTRA maybe hasn't been as tough with the networks. And so I think SAG is simply trying to ensure that its members get what they need.
So what does this mean for the negotiations, that they're not going to do it together?
The good news is that AFTRA has decided to let SAG go first, so SAG hopefully will be able to take whatever momentum it has and get a deal done, although there's this ticking clock before AFTRA comes into the equation. What it means is that, you know, the fact is these two guilds should be on the same page. You know, they're coming after the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild already reached deals. There's a lot of momentum on the side of the studios and networks to get a deal done. They sort of have some leverage because they've proven they can make deals with these other big unions. And SAG-AFTRA is coming in here without a lot of negotiating power. The fact that the two sides aren't on the same page sort of destroys whatever sort of, you know, joint levers they might have together. It sort of makes them look as if they're not all working together. It opens up a way for the studios and networks to exploit that difference. And I think they'd be a lot stronger if they simply were on the same page. It just looks like amateur hour, quite frankly.
So what happens if the producers just drag their feet for this 2-week period and then they go make a deal with AFTRA and not SAG?
It puts SAG up against the wall even more. It makes it even tougher for them to get everything that they want. That said, you know, SAG seems to be, there's still a lot of people around town who are desperately worried about a strike. And, you know, while everyone has thought that, oh, there's no way that SAG will go on strike, it's still a possibility. And that's one of the reasons we've seen a lot of momentum slow in Hollywood, especially on the movie side, is because there are these legitimate fears that there could be a SAG strike. Maybe that's what SAG wants. I don't know. But I certainly think that if a deal's done with AFTRA, it's clear that there's a lot less leverage for SAG. I mean, they're losing a big chunk of their membership.
Note the incredulity in my voice as I ask you this next question. How could they let this happen now?
They're unions. They're not, you know, there's the discipline of, you know, it's sort of like the difference between the Democratic and the Republican Party. You know, right now the Democrats have the White House in their sights. Everyone thinks there's no way that the Democrats can't win this year. But what do we see? We see the Democrats fighting with each other, beating each other up because they're messy. They're passionate. They don't care about, the process. On the other hand, the Republican Party had no problem nominating John McCain. Even if a lot of the people in the Republican Party don't really like John McCain. But you know what? They know how to win. win. Sort of the same thing here. You know, the studios and networks are a well-oiled machine that are all about getting the most money for their shareholders. Actors unions are a little more passionate, and while it may not be the best sort of strategy, I think what you're seeing is human emotion sort of spilling over into the business world.
So what does this mean for television? Like, how will this affect what we see on TV if these deals don't get done?
Well, I mean, that's the same. We just went through the writer's strike. I mean, once again, you'll see a production halt. You'll see the fall season possibly be delayed. I mean, most people still seem to think that it's a long shot. But that's the last thing the TV industry needs now, or the film industry in particular. I mean, it could really hurt the film industry if suddenly now you have once again a halt in production. You know, it's hard. This is sort of the nightmare scenario. No one really wants to think that it could actually happen. But it's the same sort of thing. If there's another strike, you know, God help us all.
Cheery news from Joe Adalian, co-TV editor at Variety. Joe, thanks for being on The Business.
You got it, Claude.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union.
Creating a show is the holy grail of television writing. You start out as a staff writer on somebody else's show and work and work and work, with the hopes that someday you'll have the respect and the relationships to pitch your own show. If you somehow manage to get the green light, you write and produce a pilot, and if you're really lucky, it gets picked up by a network. If you're even luckier still, your show makes it to syndication, and a beeping noise is heard. That's the truck backing up and unloading pallets of cash onto your front lawn. But there's lots of hard work between arriving on the Greyhound bus and having the valet park your Bentley. You must follow the well-marked road on the way to the top. And woe to any impertinent imp who dares take a shortcut. Enter impertinent imp Caroline Williams, a petite blonde from Orange County who's done just that. She got her first TV writing job, a feat in itself, then sold a spec script for a sitcom called Misguided. Against long odds, her script became a pilot, the pilot got produced, and the actual show made it to ABC.
High school can be a scary place. I know that better than anyone. My name is Becky Freely, and I'm a guidance counselor.
I hate my life.
Come on, Russell. It can't be as bad as you think.
I'm failing remedial PE. I left my inhaler on the bus, and I'm not positive, but I think I have head lice.
These kids are a delight. I love them, and understandably, they love me. It's my job to make their lives easier.
Caroline Williams, welcome to The Business.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Explain this. Like, what is the normal ladder to creating a show?
I think the normal ladder is you work on a bunch of – the thing that I didn't actually do was you work on a bunch of shows and eventually, I think, get your own show, get a development deal where you develop a show or – you know.
Give me the titles that happen along the way. First year, what? What is the absolute lowest form of life in the writer's room?
First year staff writer, then you're a story editor. There's levels of producers. And
walk me through them.
I'm not actually sure.
You don't even know what they are.
I have no idea.
You cheater.
I know.
You big fraud.
There's the guy in the blue shirt. No, there's the producer, the consulting producer, supervising producer, co-executive producer, all, I think, in somewhat order of that. And then the executive producer, who's the showrunner, sometimes the creator.
Mm-hmm.
And I went from staff writer to co-executive producer.
So you missed?
I missed a number of levels,
yes. A few levels.
Yeah.
All right. So we should point out you were a writer on The Office, the NBC comedy.
I was actually. I sold the show and sold the show Misguided and became a writer for The Office within weeks of each other.
Which happened first?
I sold the show, I think. Actually, you know what? I'm not sure. It was so close. I sold the show. I got on The Office and there was still some question as to whether the show would go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I was on The Office assuming that the show had sold, but it wasn't going to get made. And
so it wasn't as if you were like, I'm not coming to work.
Right. Yeah. No. It was pretty much the show sold, but lots of shows sell. It doesn't necessarily mean anything, you know.
So how did people at The Office take the news that you had sold this pilot?
Well, they knew that the pilot existed. And I think, you know, everyone is just, you know, you're very conservative because I think a number of people there had also sold pilots and they hadn't actually gone on to become shows. So I think there was just, it was it was they were, I think, happy for me that it had gotten picked up. It was a surprise. I think everyone...
Was it a surprise because you kept it secret?
No, they knew about it. It was a surprise that they pick it up. I think it's always a surprise. It's so hard to get a show picked up. I think it's so rare that it actually happens, especially with comedies. There's just not that many on the air. That the fact that they had ordered it, I think, was they were surprised. And very supportive, and I think...
Outwardly supportive.
Outwardly supportive, inwardly enraged.
You can't imagine the vitriol that was...
I hope not. I don't think so. Maybe. Maybe once I walked out the door, they all started freaking out, but not in front of me.
So walk me through that timeline.
Well, I...
First of all, what year were you picking up Ben Stiller's dry cleaning?
Ben Stiller's dry cleaning was 99. Mm-hmm. That was my first job out of undergrad. And I worked for a couple years. Graduated from UCLA with my master's in screenwriting in 04 and wrote the pilot in 05 and took it to an agent about a year maybe later. And it sold in April of 07. And I went to work on The Office a few weeks after that. They shot the pilot in the fall of 07. And then ABC picked up episodes in the spring of 08. So it all kind of happened within a span of a year or two.
You weren't really involved in the shooting of the pilot.
I visited the set, but not really. I mean, I definitely wasn't involved. I mean, I was working... you know, full time at The Office. So I didn't see a lot of it.
That's atypical, right?
Yeah, I think for creators, it is very atypical. I think most people are really there for everything from the beginning. But I was so happy to be on The Office that I didn't really expect it to go further than that. I mean, they shoot a lot of pilots. So I thought, oh, they'll make a pilot, and this was a great experience. But the idea that it would someday become a show was still very much, I didn't think that would happen.
Did anybody say to you, hey, they're shooting your pilot. Maybe you want to go
shape it? Yeah, it was more the watching. I did my... boss at The Office was very sweet and very supportive and would, you know, understood that it was a big experience for me to be able to see it shot. So I went down a few times to Long Beach where it was being shot at the Long Beach Poly High School, and I got to watch for a couple days. But as far as the shaping of the look of the show and you know, I knew about casting, but I certainly wasn't involved in casting every day. All that kind of stuff went on without me.
Was that the network's decision, or was it that you just didn't know even to demand to be there?
Well, I think
Or you didn't have the power to sort of throw your weight around and say, I'm Steven Bochco.
Yeah, I
didn't. Crush you like a bug.
I certainly had no power, that's for sure. But I also was very happy at The Office and was really thinking, you know, I didn't know enough to be able to say, oh, I want to be in charge of my vision. And I also wasn't put in charge. So I didn't really have that. I didn't know any better. And I also, you know, I think to their credit, they knew that I wouldn't have known what I was doing had I been put in charge. So I think, you know, it was everyone's sort of mutual agreement that I was happy on The Office and they were respecting that I had chose that as my job. And, you know, and yet they were still going to try to make the best show that they could make, which I appreciate.
After a short break, more with Caroline Williams. In a rare feat of Hollywood derring do, she got her first TV writing job and created her first series, Misguided, all pretty much at the same time. Misguided just wrapped up a 7-episode run on ABC. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. In the same year, Caroline Williams got her first job as a TV writer and created her first show, ABC's Misguided.
Lisa Germain and I had every class together for 4 years. I was an F and she was a G, so you would have thought I would have sat in front, but somehow that was never the case.
I think we had a class together. Is she the same Becky who vomited during the safe sex assembly?
Day after day, year after year, 1 foot away from each other. I memorized every inch of her long, shiny ponytail because I could never see over her giant head. But it was fine. She was fine.
To say that it's unusual to go from a novice writer to co-executive producer of a new network television show is an understatement. And the situation created some unusual tension in the writer's room.
Writing a script, obviously, as you've just pointed out, is a lot different than writing and running a show.
Right.
How have you been managing?
Well, I had help. They brought in Mark Hudis from That 70s Show was the executive producer, the showrunner on the show. But he was very supportive of me when we were writing the episodes as far as me running the room or wanting to do rewrites. He was very open to my vision, I guess.
Was there a feeling in the room? Did you get the sense of, like, who is this little girl who has subverted the primal forces of nature and insinuated herself in here? Did you feel the hierarchy pressing up against you?
Yeah, I definitely did. I mean, I think everyone was very cool to, you know, about it. But it was sort of the elephant in the room that I had the least experience of anyone in there. You know, well, that's not entirely true. Our writer's room was actually very small, but there were some very established writers there, one or two people who had, Emmys. So here I am with nothing and sort of directing them as to what to do. And I'm sure for them it must have been weird. But ultimately, I think people just have this understanding that that's how the business works. You know, one day, you know, someone's going to be your coworker, then they're your boss, then they're your assistant. I mean, I think everything is very fluid. In a writer's room, it's not necessarily a traditional hierarchy. The person with the most experience doesn't necessarily have the most power. Things are sort of sometimes upturned. So I think people were surprised, but not entirely.
It was sort of like classic Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can't really – I guess Hollywood is sort of it's not always a – meritocracy, where the person with the most talent or the most experience isn't always at the top. So I think people are aware of that. And, you know, not that I was the least talented or the least experienced, but I think you're always aware that you're not always going to be working for, you know, somebody who's been in the business longer than you.
All right. So first of all, we should point out that your title is co-executive producer.
Right.
In that there's a reason for that. What is the reason for that?
Well, I don't think I had enough experience to be the executive producer. The executive producer is usually the showrunner, often the creator. But I don't think that they can give that title to somebody who has never done it before.
Mm-hmm. So you've already kind of, they don't even know what to make of you. They don't know what to.
Exactly.
Like Hannibal Lecter. They don't have a name for what she is.
Exactly.
So walk me through the practical how you learn.
Well,
while at the same time, like how you make sure your vision gets. I mean, this is your idea. You alone know what, like, Judy Greer is supposed to be doing and saying. It's your show. But you don't really know how to do a show. So, like, how do you manage that tension?
I think the practical aspect of running a show or having a show was everything I learned on The Office. I mean, the experience with Greg was so educational and so fantastic because he's not only one of the funniest people I've ever met.
You're talking about Greg Daniels. Greg Daniels, the guy who runs the Office.
Exactly. He's not only one of the funniest people I've ever met. He also runs a really great show. I mean, all the writers are happy. Everyone is very creative. Everyone is heard. You know, the show runs off. You know, the show is made really seamlessly. And so I basically just followed everything he did. The way that room was run, I tried to do the same thing. The way he put a card on the board, I put cards on the board that way. The way that he made binders for the shows, I made binders for the show. The way that, you know, I even, one of the writer's PAs from The Office was looking to become a writer's assistant, and I brought him with me because I knew that he knew how Greg did things. And I thought that must be how a good show is run because it really worked so well.
So the show gets picked up. I want to ask you sort of the trappings of success question.
Is
there anything that you do, not just because you want to, because, oh, I've always wanted to, you know, I could never rub two nickels together and now I'm going to buy like every pair of Jimmy Choos I always wanted or something like that. But like, did you have to go out and do things to sort of outwardly show like, you know, I'm an executive producer.
Right.
Like, do you have to carry like a BlackBerry now or something?
I think no matter what I do, I mean, I'm sort of a small woman. There's nothing I can do is going to make me look like I'm in charge. So I didn't even bother. I dress the same way. I carry myself the same way. There's really, I don't, if you're looking to look at me and feel like a sense of respect, it's not going to happen. There's just nothing about me that commands employees to respect me, so I gave up.
Had Misguided not been picked up, you would have just stayed a writer, but it did. It got picked up, and that changes everything in a way for you in sort of the way you're perceived in Hollywood and what avenues are available to you. We hope it runs, you know, more longer than MASH, but if it does go away, can you really just go back to being a writer? I mean, you were quoted as saying, oh, I guess I could go be an assistant. But like, you were kidding, I think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But can you go back to being a writer, or do you now have, you know, what can you do if this opportunity goes away?
Pretty much anything can happen. I don't feel like I don't want to go work on someone else's show, because I certainly would love to do that as well. I would do just about anything. I'm hoping it gets picked up, but if it doesn't, there's definitely other shows that I would love to work on and other pilots that I want to write and things like that. So I'm just trying not to even think about it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you asked, you know, agents or whatever if they would want their client to go back to doing the same thing, but I definitely think, you know, I don't want to skip ahead. I don't want to, you know, only be co-EP on my own show forever, because I haven't had a lot of experience, and I don't mind going back and getting that experience. You know, at the same time, I feel like I learned a lot, so I guess it would be kind of weird to go back and be considered the person on, you know, the bottom of the totem pole, but I wouldn't mind doing it. I enjoyed the experience so much that I would definitely do it again.
Do you think people would let you?
I don't know. I think so. I mean, frankly, there's so few jobs there's so many great writers I know that aren't working that it seems like if you get a writing job at all, you sort of jump at the chance just because, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities.
Caroline Williams is the creator of Misguided. It airs on ABC. Caroline, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you so much.
Misguided just wrapped up a 7-episode run on ABC. And Caroline Williams is waiting to hear if they'll be picked up again. We'll let you know what happens. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
I love my job.
Yeah? Why?
It's like my car out there. My whole life I've wanted that car, and I never thought I would have it. And now it's mine. I can't believe I'm so lucky. Was that?
It was.